Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why Americans may not be able to apply the most effective sunscreens. And a podcast makes the case for the boss himself, Bruce Springsteen, as a queer icon. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court last week ruled in favor of an Oregon town and its ordinance prohibiting people experiencing homelessness from camping in public spaces. Known as the Grants Pass case, after the name of that Oregon community, the majority said enforcing the bans did not constitute cruel and unusual punishment. In response to the ruling, the city of Phoenix said it would not criminalize homelessness. Groups that help those experiencing homelessness, though, say they're concerned about the impact of the decision. Nicole Santa Cruz has been reporting on this specifically in Albuquerque for ProPublica and joins me to talk about what she's found. Nicole, good morning.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So you have been speaking with a lot of folks in sort of who are experiencing homelessness, groups that are trying to help them in and around Albuquerque, New Mexico. What kinds of things did you hear from them before this ruling late last week?
Yeah, so before this ruling, I traveled to Albuquerque and talked to people who told me that while removing encampments, the city had discarded very important items that they needed to survive, like tents, blankets, sleeping bags, clothing, IDs, birth certificates, social security cards, and then in some cases, sentimental items like ashes or family photos.
So what was the rationale behind that from law enforcement in Albuquerque? Like, why did they say they were doing that?
So the mayor actually said that he wanted to clear encampments in the city, that encampments were not going to be tolerated in Albuquerque. But they said that basically, they could do that because, they said that they weren't throwing people's property away. So they denied violating their own city policy. And they said that they followed their policy, which was to store possessions that are kind of left at an encampment. But they actually don't do that.
So you mentioned that, you know, some of the items that were either thrown away or stored, however, you know, I guess it depends on which side you talk to. Some of them were sort of logistical things that people needed, like IDs. Some were more sentimental. You mentioned, I think you reported on one person who lost her dentures, and she was very concerned about how that would impact maybe her ability to get a job and be able to not be homeless anymore.
Yeah, so she was really upset about losing her dentures because it was really difficult to obtain those dentures in the first place. You have to have multiple appointments to get them. And so when they were thrown away, she was heartbroken because first off, she just felt unattractive, like no one would want to hire her without any teeth. And then there's the practical implications of that, which is that she can't eat. It disrupts, you know, being able to eat. She can't eat hard foods. She has to eat soft foods. So, you know, it had an enormous impact on her life.
So what are folks saying about what may or may not change in the wake of this ruling? Like, how might what you found in Albuquerque before the ruling be affected by what the Supreme Court did?
Yeah, so if cities enact more camping bans, that could require an increased law enforcement presence, which could increase the loss of property. If you have a city that's trying to enforce a camping ban, enforcing a camping ban is going to mean removing encampments or sweeping, and that those interactions frequently lead to loss of property, even if cities have the policies in place to prevent that property loss.
So, I mean, is there any hope that cities maybe can enforce these bans and not just toss people's stuff? Like, is there a way? Does anybody think there is actually a workable way to make it so that cities can enforce their ordinances while not just getting rid of people's stuff?
Well, I think they just have to be very careful about the way that they do it. And if they have a policy in place, they actually have to adhere to the policy. So if, say, a city has a storage program where they say that they will store people's property left at encampments, then they actually have to store people's property and communicate the storage program, let people know about it, and also make it accessible so that people can go and retrieve their belongings if they're taken in a cleanup.
So obviously, you know, cities and towns have known that this case was working its way through the courts. A ruling had been expected for a little while. Based on your reporting, did you have the sense that cities were doing anything to try to prepare for this or thinking about how they might respond and maybe change or amend ordinances based on what the Supreme Court ruled?
I've heard from advocates that cities have either policies that they are starting to pass, or they're seeking advice or information from their city attorneys to determine just what they can do now in terms of punishing people for sleeping outside. I know that various cities have enacted camping bans. So now it's, you know, how strict are they going to be in enforcing their camping bans? Are they going to charge people or not?
Well, I wonder if that's sort of the difference here, if the ordinances themselves might look relatively similar from city to city, but the level of enforcement might be where some are differentiated.
Yes, definitely. So it's about what is actually happening on the streets and how many people are actually being cited. And then also who's actually being prosecuted, because sometimes people can be cited, but they're not actually prosecuted for these crimes.
Do you get the sense that cities are really like trying to figure out how to walk that tightrope of enforcement while also not, as the city of Phoenix said it wouldn't do, criminalize homelessness?
I think it remains to be seen what happens and the posture that cities take regarding this issue.
All right. Fair enough. That is Nicole Santa Cruz, reporter with ProPublica. Nicole, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sunscreen is important anywhere, but especially here in the Valley with its 300 plus days of sunshine every year. But the kind of sunscreen available to consumers in the U.S. is apparently not as effective as that in other parts of the world. Michael Scaturo has written about this. He's a journalist based in Atlanta, where he reports on healthcare issues for Kaiser Health News and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I spoke with him earlier and asked what the differences are between the sunscreens one can buy in the U.S. and those that one can buy elsewhere.
So the sunscreens that people are buying or able to buy in the U.S. are basically made from sunscreen filters that are quite old, that basically people were using in Europe and in Asia like 20, 30, even 40 years ago. So that's the main difference. The filters that people who make sunscreens in Japan and South Korea and France and Germany, etc., those filters are newer. They're just newer products. And I think you could compare it to like using an older computer, right? I mean, if you think back to the 90s, we had these like clunky, plasticky, gigantic computers, right? And that's kind of what American sunscreens are like. They're just really old. They're using technology from the 80s, really, because that's how old these filters are. And Europe, Asia, the rest of the world are basically using like brand new iPhones.
Does that mean that we are getting less good protection from the sun than other places are?
Yeah, that's definitely what's happening. We're seeing, for instance, that the sun basically has something called UV light, right? And it's comes essentially in three forms. Yeah. UVC, which is filtered out by the atmosphere. UVB, which is a very small percentage, but burns the skin. And then UVA, which is actually most of the ultraviolet light. And the sunscreens in the U.S. have a number on them. So if you see like 50 on the front of a sunscreen, that means that the sunscreen has a 50 rating for blocking UVB. But the sunscreens in Europe, basically when they have 50 or something like that on the front of the bottle, that means that they block UVB and UVA to a certain level. And the issue is in the U.S., like our sunscreens are really only, like you would really only know when you buy a sunscreen in a store that the sunscreen has a certain UVB blocking potential. The FDA has put in place certain regulations. They've basically said that sunscreens that use the broad spectrum nomenclature or broad spectrum label have to have a certain amount of UVA blocking potential. But the FDA's own studies, other studies have shown that the US sunscreens don't even meet that standard and fall far short of the UVA blocking standard that is in place in Europe.
I mean, that seems like a pretty significant problem. If people are using this American sunscreen and going out in the sun, like that seems, frankly, like a recipe for skin cancer.
Well, and that's actually happened. You may have seen in the article that skin cancer is now the number one cancer in the U.S.
Yeah.
It's really, really becoming a problem. It's not the most deadly cancer, obviously. Breast cancer, the second most cancer, is quite deadly. But the problem is it's completely avoidable. So the advantage of these European sunscreens, of course, Asian sunscreens, European sunscreens, is that they have a very high ability to block UVA light, which is what we're exposed to every day, which is really what causes the damage to the skin.
Well, so as you report, there are various reasons with the federal government that American sunscreens are not doing that. Has there been any movement to allow American companies to start using some of those products that the Europeans and the Asians are using to make sure that we can have better products and more protective products?
Well, I think there has been some movement. There is one company, there's a Swiss company that makes a really high-tech UVA filtering, actually UVA and UVB filtering sunscreen ingredient, and they're trying to get this ingredient through the FDA. The ingredient's called bemitrizinol, so they call it BEMT for short. But the issue, of course, is that sunscreens in the U.S. are not regulated like cosmetics, as they are in most other countries. So in like, you know, any country in the world, sunscreen is regulated like lipstick or mascara, that sort of thing. But in the U.S., sunscreen is classified as an over-the-counter drug, like Advil or Zyrtec nasal spray.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, it has to go through a lot more checks that the other countries wouldn't necessarily subject new sunscreens or sunscreen ingredients to. So in order to create more momentum, let's say, around this, to get more and newer sunscreen ingredients passed, Congress has actually twice tried to pass through legislation acts that would urge the FDA to speed up the process, right? One occurred in 2019, and then 2021 during the pandemic, actually, there was another piece of legislation. And those legislative attempts haven't really succeeded because the FDA has said, well, you know, we have a huge dossier, we have a lot of things to look at, and Congress hasn't really given us the funds or the resources to look at things like sunscreen. So this most recent legislative attempt creates almost like a funding stream that the FDA will use to hire more people. But of course, there's a backlog, right? Because this was passed in 2021 and the pandemic meant that people were not really working, or many people were working from home. So really, like, they're just getting caught up with that.
Couldn't Congress or the FDA or whomever is in charge of this just reclassify sunscreen as a cosmetic as opposed to an over-the-counter drug?
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because right now there's another legislative attempt. It's called the FDA Modernization Act 3.0. It's a bipartisan bill. And that bill is sort of like, it's sort of like a compromise, because the FDA, I think, would probably push back on reclassifying right now as it stands, because they say, you know, this is a product that makes a claim. And for that reason, you know, we would not really feel comfortable reclassifying sunscreen as a cosmetic. But what Congress is trying to do is essentially give the FDA permission to waive animal testing. So this bill, the FDA Modernization Act 3.0, which is moving through a committee right now in Congress, would basically be like a middle ground. So cosmetics would still be sunscreens would still be classified as cosmetics, but they would not be subject to animal testing. So I think that's kind of where Congress and the FDA have sort of met a compromise.
Michael Scaturo is a journalist based in Atlanta, where he reports on healthcare issues for Kaiser Health News and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what is it about Bruce Springsteen that makes his music so appealing to some queer people?
I knew he wasn't a queer singer. I'm making the assumption he's not a queer singer. Who knows? It didn't matter to me because it was the lyrics and the feeling that mattered more than anything.
We'll hear from two podcasters on a quest to determine whether or not Bruce Springsteen is, in fact, a queer icon. But first, the Department of Justice's scathing investigation into the Phoenix Police Department revealed a pattern of discrimination against people of color, the homeless, and those with serious mental illness, as well as excessive use of force and lack of accountability. And our next guest says these are patterns he sees all the time in his work. Attorney Steve Benedetto takes on the cases of people who say they're victims of police violence, and he told my co-host Lauren Gilger they are rarely successful in court. His firm represents the protesters who say they were wrongfully arrested by Phoenix police and fraudulently indicted by the Maricopa County Attorney's Office as a gang, as originally reported by ABC 15. Those charges are part of what led to the DOJ's investigation into the Phoenix PD. But Benedetto didn't start out as an attorney focused on civil rights. Here's his conversation with Lauren.
So it is August of 2014, just a regular weeknight. And I'm sitting at home watching CNN with my wife. And all of a sudden, there's this news flash. And I see what I think is some kind of war breaking out in the Middle East. I see tanks and armored vehicles and kind of mounted machine guns and smoke and grenade smoke everywhere. And then I see the byline, and it's Ferguson, Missouri. Mm. I have no clue where Ferguson is. I've never heard of it. But it sparked this interest of what is happening in Ferguson, Missouri, and why does it look like there's a war going on? At the time, I was doing a lot of personal injury work and some criminal defense. My background was in kind of big corporate law. Hadn't really thought a lot about doing civil rights work. I had, I think, one civil rights case in 10 years. But at that point, once I dug into what was going on in Missouri at that time, it just felt like I didn't really have much of another choice. I had to explore this area because it really just seemed really underserved. Mm-hmm. And seeing the degree to which the police have been militarized and the threats on ordinary citizens' rights really concern me as an attorney and as someone who was involved in the system.
It's really interesting. So you kind of leave that work, you found this firm, and you start taking on these cases. Basically, you're saying that no one else wants. So these are cases of protesters who have been prosecuted, right? You've done a lot of those cases, but also victims of police violence.
Correct. Victims and survivors. So We have on the victim end of it, the folks that have been shot and killed by police. We've had a lot of those cases. We've turned down a lot of those cases over the years. There's a fairly depressing flow of those cases coming in, far too many. And then we have survivors as well, people that survive police and state violence and then live to tell the story and seek justice within the system.
How often are these cases successful?
Very rarely. It does happen. There are the cases we all hear about in the media, mm-hmm. and they get reported, millions of dollars of settlements. And I think it can create the misnomer that these cases are largely successful. And in fact, it's exactly the opposite. Hmm. Most cases do not settle. Most cases do not make it to trial. They get dismissed by the court, often on qualified immunity. That's the most well-known version of kind of a procedural technicality that leads to dismissal.
What does that mean exactly? Explain that.
Qualified immunity is a doctrine created by the Supreme Court to protect officers from all but the most egregious forms of unconstitutional conduct. The Supreme Court decided that we don't want officers being sued for the same types of things that everyone else can be sued for, doctors and lawyers and people on the roadway. We don't want ordinary negligence standards. We want officers to only be sued if they know someone has a constitutional right and they're acting to specifically violate that right. So the way that's taken shape in the modern case law is that in order to survive qualified immunity and actually be able to present your case to a trial, you have to point to a prior similar case with virtually identical facts. I'll give you a direct example from here in Tempe. Mm-hmm. We represented a man named Ivan Oakry who was holding his baby in his apartment when three City of Tempe police officers tased him. He almost fell on his child and injured the child. Fortunately, turned before he hit the ground, but was tased simultaneously three times by three officers while he was holding his child. And our argument was this is clearly excessive force. And the court didn't necessarily disagree that it was excessive force, but said there isn't a case that says that officers are not able to tase a man while he's holding his baby. Therefore, qualified immunity excuses the officer's conduct. It just means the officer will not be held liable in court, and you don't get your day in court in terms of an opportunity to present the case to trial.
Yeah. So there are some big cases with big settlements and lots of money for victims of police violence that we'll all hear about once in a while. Those are not the norm and not generally the cases you're taking on as well. Are the people that you're representing more complicated? Is this about, you know, most people in these situations with police being, you know, imperfect sort of quote-unquote victims?
I think that's part of it. What happens with the civil justice system generally is even those of us who might live more perfect lives than others, when we get on the business end of the government and the civil justice system, we find out just how imperfect we are because the government dredges up everything it can on us. So we have had clients that look great on paper, but it turns out that 12 years earlier, there was a domestic violence incident, or there was a bankruptcy, or they went to therapy because they were abused sexually as a child. Those are the kinds of things that the defendant, in many cases, but especially civil rights cases, really weaponizes against people. So that tends to yield lower settlement values and lower case values when you're dealing with someone that has prior issues. And then, as you mentioned, a lot of folks that have regular contact with police tend to have more complicated criminal backgrounds.
Are there patterns in the kinds of cases that you take on? Do you see the same kinds of stories over and over and over again?
We see the same kinds of stories in the sense that we see the same kinds of races of people. And it's probably no surprise to anyone who's read the DOJ report within the city of Phoenix. We see a lot of black folks. We see a lot of Hispanic folks. It's very, very common and strikingly commonly, uncomfortable as a middle-aged white guy to get so many calls from a community that's not massive in Phoenix. We're not dealing, you know, this isn't Detroit or Philadelphia with a large historic black population. There's a modest and very, very long history of African-Americans in Phoenix and history of redlining and history of racism. And that carries over very much into today, unfortunately. And that's a lot of what we see. Not exclusive. We get calls from white people from time to time, too. But by and large, those are the common threads we see more often than anything else.
The pattern is racial. Well,
yeah.
So let's talk about the DOJ investigation. This was, I think a lot of people had heard the stories, not incredibly surprised what they found. And Phoenix police have said that they're making changes. The chief has said that he's implementing accountability tactics and training and things like that. I wonder what your take is on this, because cases that you took on, particularly regarding protesters, were part of what led to this DOJ report.
Yeah. And so it's interesting. The protest section of the report is probably the least developed. It's what, like you said, what got the DOJ here in the first place. And yet we see far more substance directed towards other areas. But I think if you look at this report, what you also see is there was a clear pattern of the city of Phoenix not cooperating with the investigation on First Amendment issues. It's referenced in footnotes in the First Amendment section. The DOJ talks about how the city of Phoenix did not provide reports into the Tactical Response Unit, which was the First Amendment protest response unit. They did not provide the DOJ with access to prior investigators who'd investigated this exact subject matter, prohibited them from speaking with them. And they allowed 40 separate police officers to refuse to talk to them and did nothing about it.
Where do those cases stand? Many of those protester cases, the ones that made news, got the DOJ here and, you know, were a big deal here. Have you been successful in those lawsuits?
We have been successful at defeating rounds of motions to dismiss. So when these lawsuits get filed, the city and most cities respond to them with an effort to get them thrown out of court right away. That litigation process often takes months. In these cases, has taken years. The most recent round, I think, was the third round of motions to dismiss. We've, I think, gotten somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 motions to dismiss in this case.
Mm-hmm.
That was just denied by the court in March. And now the cases are moving forward to discovery, where officers and the protesters will actually have their depositions taken and be producing documents that are relevant to the case.
So let me ask you lastly, before I let you go here, Steve, just about your overall goals and maybe, I guess, expectations. Like, there's been widespread criticism of this DOJ report from the police unions, some city council members. On the other hand, though, the people who have been outspoken about the problems with the police department are also not happy about this report because they say we're not going to see any changes as a result of it because the DOJ will not make that happen. Do you fall in one of those camps somewhere in the middle?
I'd say somewhere in the middle, but much closer to the latter camp. I am skeptical, based on my research, of the power of a consent judgment to affect long-lasting change. That is not a substitution for a belief that something drastic has to happen in this department. And what I think needs to happen is the DOJ needs to sue the city of Phoenix and take the power of the federal government and sue the city of Phoenix and actually get a federal ruling that the city has violated the Constitution in all the ways that they've found. One of the reasons why the community is very skeptical is because historically consent judgments don't result in the type of change that actually saves people's lives and protects people. Mm-hmm. What does that is reducing police size and reducing jurisdiction in areas where maybe they shouldn't have it, like mental health crises. Those are the kinds of things that a judge can order in an injunction. It's the kind of thing that if the city of Phoenix were willing to hold its police department accountable would be in a consent decree.
Hmm. All right. We will leave it there for now. Steve Benedetto, founder and attorney of the People's Law Firm, joining us. Steve, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
We asked the Phoenix Police Department and the mayor's office to respond to Benedetto. You can read their responses at theshow.kjzz.org. And you are listening to The Show. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Water and the future of water supplies continue to be critical issues both here in Arizona and across the world. And a new entity at ASU will aim to help find solutions to those concerns. Upmanu Lal is a professor in ASU School of Complex Adaptive Systems and director of the new Water Institute at the Julianne Wrigley Global Futures Laboratory. He joins me to talk about this new center. And Upmanu, what is the goal of this new enterprise?
Yeah, so my previous job was at Columbia University in New York. And there I was leading the Columbia Water Center, which was part of the Earth Institute. And the goal there is similar to the goal that we have at ASU, which is if you look around from a sustainability perspective, water is central to almost all aspects of life. And I argue typically that if you look at the biggest impacts of climate, and of course, climate change aggravates those impacts, water is central to them. Sitting in Arizona or particularly in Phoenix, you probably think that temperature is also equally important. But if you didn't have water, Phoenix would not exist, period. Whereas definitely, you know, warmer temperature creates stress. So the purpose of what we are trying to do with the Water Institute is to bring together the capacity at the university to look for solutions to challenging water and climate problems worldwide, not just in Arizona.
So how will the work that this institute does differ from, you know, any of the work that other folks either in Arizona or elsewhere are doing?
Yeah, so the typical model in a public university in the U.S. is that you have a water research institute for the state that you're in. So the idea that we are viewing this from a global lens is different. And, you know, to be fair, there have been other universities that have tried to have global water programs, but they've really tried to just do what they were doing locally as a, you know, hydrologic exercise or as a water treatment systems exercise and saying, hey, we are going to go out to Africa and do the same thing or something like that. What we are trying to do is to recognize that water and climate from a global perspective are inseparable. And similarly, whether you look at water treatment, whether you look at floods, or if you look at water supply for agriculture, we need to look at it from the same lens and integrate these. And that lens incorporates infrastructure. It's not just the study of the science associated with moving water or the science associated with treatment. It's about how do you build an infrastructure that brings all those elements into the 21st century.
So when you look at the issue of water globally, are there things that Arizona does well that you think could be exported to other places? And conversely, what kinds of lessons maybe do other places, you know, what kind of things do other places do, lessons they have learned that maybe Arizona could bring in and adapt here?
Yeah, those are really good questions, because one of the first things we have done is to form a global water collaboratory. Why we are doing this, and it's to really bring together the response exactly to your question. What are the things that we do well? So at ASU specifically, we have world-leading scientists on biological wastewater treatment, on physical chemical water treatment, on atmospheric water technologies, and so forth. And we hope to have the world's top program on climate science as it applies to water. And so those are the things, those are the examples of the kinds of things we want to contribute. What we learn from other folks, look, if I look at places in India, there are people who've been living in some of those places in desert conditions where the summer temperature is consistently above 110. So if Phoenix is headed there, we need to understand how those people have been making it the whole time without air conditioning for centuries, right? So a lot of that goes into the way the houses are built and shaded, and the circulation integrates the circulation of air from subsurface conditions where the temperatures really get above 55 degrees. So there's a lot that we can learn from both directions, and we are already taking steps to do that.
When you talk about the link between water and climate, I wonder if you almost, when it comes to, you know, planning for water use and water scarcity in the future, do you almost have to maybe take it on two tracks? You know, one plan for, you know, if climate change continues in the way that a lot of scientists say that it will, and one if we are able to sort of stop it or reduce it somewhat. I would imagine those would be sort of two different plans of action as it relates to water use.
What we are trying to do is think about ways by which we can apply the understanding of how climate itself works to two things. One is could we regulate the supply of water, both on floods and what happens on an annual basis? And second, how do we anticipate some of these things and then design use systems that are robust to whatever nature throws at us, basically? So my personal research, one of the things that I'm trying to work on is it possible with small amounts of energy to shift the trajectory of atmospheric rivers so that if they were going to have landfall in a place which already is wet at that particular time and would get catastrophically flooded if the atmospheric river landed there, we move it where the water now ends up going where we need it.
Well, that's so interesting. You're talking about potentially taking a storm, a major rainstorm that was going to hit California maybe and cause massive flooding, and just shifting it eastward maybe to a place like Arizona where our reservoirs could really use the rain. Like that seems like science fiction.
Yeah. What I'll say in response to that is that many of the things that we use today were predicted in the 1950s by science fiction writers, but not by scientists.
So one of the big conversations, as I'm sure you know, here in Arizona, is the conversation and the discussion, I guess, between water conservation and water augmentation and sort of which role each of those has. I'm curious to get your thoughts on the roles of conservation versus the roles of finding new sources of water.
So my response to that is if you're in a place like Arizona, you have to be at the forefront of both of those. Phoenix has turned from a sleepy little place to a hustling, bustling city, which is the fifth largest metro in the country. How do you preserve that metro if you don't do both of those things? It's not an either or. You know, we have to be doing both, and we have to be aggressive about that and judicious about that. So that's my short answer to that one.
Sure. All right. Utmanu Lal, Director of the Water Institute at ASU. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for it.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, joined now in studio by the show's Sam Dingman. Hey there, Sam.
Good morning. Mark, when I say the name Bruce Springsteen, what comes to mind?
For me, so many things, but probably most immediately that very famous cover of the record of Born in the USA.
Oh, yes. Springsteen facing the American flag, plain white T-shirt, ball cap in the pocket. Some people might be imagining Darkness on the Edge of Town Springsteen, though. Messy hair, unzipped jacket, leaning against the wall. These are iconic looks from an iconic rock star. And if you love Springsteen, you probably remember where you were when you heard the songs from those records for the first time. And Mark, if you're our age, maybe you remember holding the cover art in your hands while you listened to the music. And these images of Bruce and what he represents, they just get seared in your mind.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, Springsteen is kind of as much of an idea, like an ideal maybe even, as he is a person.
Absolutely. But what is that idea? Our next two guests would argue that it can be whatever you need it to be. Jessie Lou Lawson is a radio producer and a drag artist who performs under the name Butch Springsteen. And Holly Cassio is a queer zine and comic artist who has written extensively about their love of Bruce. They have just released a multi-part podcast called Because the Boss Belongs to Us. And in it, they're making the case that Bruce Springsteen should be added to the pantheon of queer icons.
I would love to start by having you both tell us, and Jessie, let's start with you, and then we'll go to Holly. What are the Bruce lyrics that you first heard that made you think, this person is singing to me?
When I was in the middle of kind of coming out, I would say, to like my friends and family and workplace, it was also a time where I was really into karaoke. So much so that my friends bought us a karaoke machine as a present to my flat. So we did lots and lots of karaoke. And me and my flatmate at the time, we were perfecting our performance of Thunder Road together. I love it musically because there's no choruses and no verses. It's just one story all the way through. A very, very beautiful story. And then it ends with this line that is, it's a town full of losers and I'm pulling out of here to win. And then there's this amazing saxophone from Clarence Clemons. And that is like, for a little while when I was in this bit of my life where I was coming out, every time I sang that on karaoke, I would cry. So that is like a very specific line for me that I really love.
Holly, what about you?
The first song that like I remember having this like immediate gut-wrenching physical reaction to was Dancing in the Dark. I'd always heard the song as like just a kind of general pop song, and I was sitting in my bedroom making a mixtape for someone I was in love with. I was like 13, 14, I was queer, but I wasn't out yet. And the lyrics of that song just made me realise, oh my God, this is about me and my life. Like the lyrics, I want to change my clothes, my hair, my face. That is such like a queer like moment of like, oh, no one understands me. But there's this particular line where he says, there's something happening somewhere, baby, I just know that there is. And this feeling I had of like complete isolation when you're like a queer teenager in a small town when the internet doesn't really exist yet and you don't really have connection to queer people and queer communities, that was such a physical, tangible line for me. It didn't feel like just a throwaway pop song anymore. It felt like this is a queer anthem.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you do so well in the show and that you've both just done here is talk about how meaningful that moment is when you discover an artist who feels like they're singing directly to you. But in my experience, sometimes that feeling can be accompanied by a sense of disappointment when you realize other people love them also. You know, like you want that feeling to be just for you. But my sense of both of you is that it was exhilarating not just to find this sense of connection with Bruce, but to discover that other queer people in particular were having similar reactions. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think also it's this, we've spoken about this a lot. There's like a specific way that queer people do being a fan. And also more than that, that queer people do like fashion or nightlife, like lots of different things where I think one of the core things in that is trying to find and build community. There's something that we talk about in episode one, which is there was a law in the UK called Section 28, which banned any, it was what they said was the promotion of homosexuality by local authorities, which meant that there was like absolutely no out teachers in schools and no like LGBT sex education. And so there's like all of these reasons that we've been kind of like torn apart from each other and had to have these kind of lonely experiences of working ourselves out. And so I think often, you know, someone will say, literally, like, why did we make this podcast? So that we could meet other queer Breeze fans. Like, all of the kind of weird, intricate things that you do are ultimately just about, like, finding friends and finding connection and being together.
Yeah, definitely. The weird thing, though, at the time, because I grew up under Section 28, so all of my schooling was, you know, you couldn't talk about being queer. There was no books, no literature, no discussion, no one to talk to for, like, confidential advice. So that was my experience of being a young person. Before I listened to Breeze, I was already listening to like queercore punk. So I was listening to hardcore, queer, radical punk. And that was inspiring as well. Like that absolutely saved my life. But there was something about hearing Breeze singing, this cis white straight man, that kind of, I don't know, the platform that he had, the stage that he had, the presence that he had, it just shifted something for me. It wasn't this kind of underground queer radical movement. It was this kind of big bombastic anthem that was played on mainstream radio. And I knew he wasn't a queer singer, or I'm making the assumption he's not a queer singer, who knows. It didn't matter to me because it was the lyrics and the feeling that mattered more than anything.
Well, one of the most fascinating things about the show is that you also talk about the ways that Bruce's visual presentation, particularly on his album covers, could be interpreted as queer-coded in a lot of cases. How much of his resonance is purely musical? Do you think he would still feel as much like an icon to you if only one or the other of those things felt queer-coded?
I don't know if I can separate those two things. And I think it's that thing where, like, once you notice one thing, so once you're like, oh, these lyrics are, like, so relatable to a queer experience, and then you're looking at pictures of him here and you're like, oh, like, he's dressed in a studded leather jacket, like, pouting with a pink background, like, he looks like, you know, five of my, like, twink friends. And then you read his autobiography and he says in his autobiography, like, looking back on these looks, I look gay, and you're like, oh yes. But I think it's like we talk about a lot in the show is like there's definitely a Bruce Springsteen that exists in our brains that we actually have no idea is anything like the real Bruce Springsteen. And also neither of us know whether that matters.
Yeah, I'd say it definitely doesn't matter. It's more fun to kind of play dress up with Bruce and kind of ask yourself, like, do I want to be him? Or, like, do I want to date him? Like, I'm not quite sure. And the great thing about Bruce and all of his looks is that depending on what mood you're in or depending on what level of your journey you're in and, like, your queerness, there's a Bruce for everyone. So if you like the macho Bruce, you've got it. If you want, like, the more, like, leather twink Bruce, you've got it. If you want soft, butch, lesbian vibe Bruce, there's a Bruce for everyone.
Sure, sure. Yeah. That makes sense. And you actually, both of you in that answer, anticipated one of my other questions, which was, what would it feel like to know if Bruce embraces his status as a queer icon or if he was to reject it?
Yeah, I think I'm quite happy just to kind of live with my imagined Bruce Springsteen because he can't let me down. Queers have this amazing skill of being able to take art and take popular culture and make it mean what they need it to mean. So whether that's a TV show or a book or a person or a song or an album, and whether it was intended to be or not, it can become this really important and empowering piece of art which helps you get out of bed in the morning or makes you feel seen or makes you feel recognised and gives you the energy that you need to go along and do your business. And so I think at the end of this incredibly scientific study, if the results come back negative or maybe even inconclusive, I'm still happy to consider Bruce Springsteen as the queer icon of my dreams.
All right. Well, Holly Cassio and Jesse Lou Lawson, co-hosts of Because the Boss Belongs to Us, Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for having
us. Thank you. It was so nice, Sam. Thank you for reaching out.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Reminder, you can always follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, Gabriella Fernbaugh, and reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, our news director. The show is created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. You say you gotta stay hungry.